feels better. Let me entertain you from the 1959 musical Gypsy, and the man who wrote those lyrics is a master of the American musical theatre. He's composer and lyricist Stephen Sondheim. His musicals, of which there are so many, are just gold. They're loved by audiences, and I can tell you they are loved by performers as well. Stephen Sondheim pretty much revolutionised the musical with hits including Sweeney Todd and A Little Light Music. He wrote the lyrics for West Side Story. He's won an Academy Award, 8 Tonys, multiple Grammys, a Pulitzer Prize, and heaps more. And he's in Melbourne to see the umpteenth revival of one of his own hits. It's called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and it stars Geoffrey Rush. And Stephen Sondheim joins me in the studio right now, live in person. Welcome to Books and Arts.
Thank you very much.
Nice to have you
here. Nice to be here.
You've been to see A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum in Melbourne.
Last night.
What did you think?
Wow, I loved it. Of course, it was 5 hours after getting off the airplane, but I wasn't jet-lagged as soon as I sat in that seat. It's really funny and really... It's really good. It's in fact better than I expected it to be, because I thought it was such an American show, and it isn't at all. It's really it goes anywhere.
You wrote the lyrics and the music for the show. Where did the inspiration come from? Do you remember?
Which?
For the show.
The expression?
Well, the whole show. I mean, where did you get the idea?
It wasn't my idea. It was the idea of one of the librettists. The book is written by Bert Shevlov and Larry Gelbart. Larry Gelbart might be known to listeners as the author of MASH, the TV show, and it was Bert's idea. Bert was a lyricist himself, and he had this notion of doing a musical farce based on the plays of Plautus, the Roman playwright who, in fact, invented the situation comedy, and that's not an exaggeration. Virtually every situation comedy that exists today would not be there if it wasn't for Plautus, who invented the domestic comedy in which, you know, there were people, wily slaves and con men and domestic quarrels and that sort of thing.
And it's got a lot of vaudeville about it, hasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
In fact, it is.
Bert called it a scenario for vaudevillians.
It's a lot of slapstick. It's one of those things where people, crash into each other.
That's right. But with a very intricate plot that causes that. It's not just arbitrary. I think it's the most brilliant farce ever written, and I would defend that in a court of law. And I'm not talking about anything of my work. I'm talking about what they wrote, because it took 4 years to write. It sounds as if it was made up of an afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning, but in fact, it took a very long time to write because it is so intricately constructed. There are no jokes in it. Everything is situation.
Yeah, there's no gags.
No jokes.
That's true. I mean, the one thing I think needs to be said about the show is that the sexual politics have dated a lot, haven't they?
Yes.
The women are sort of ditzy.
They're either ditzy or they're harridans or something like that, the way they were when Plautus wrote them, of course. So, you know, things have changed
in
2,000 years.
And in the way that was acceptable, too, in theatre when you wrote it. But today you couldn't write a show like this because people would say, you can't depict women like this.
No, it has to be seen as a period farce. And in fact, I'm not even sure if I don't think even back when the show was written, if it had been set in contemporary times in 1962, I don't think it would have been acceptable even back then. Although there is a tradition of British farces, for example, in which women are treated that way.
Yes, there is. I mean, I must say, as I was watching it, I thought this has been brilliantly done, and the songs are great, and it's a beautifully made show. But there was a part of me that just couldn't give over totally to it, because I thought, I just can't laugh at the treatment of women like this.
There's no pretense to its being in any way, what should we say, naturalistic or realistic. It is about drag, and it is about the kinds of things.
It's happening at a sort of screwball.
In fact, it would be wrong to make the women as strong characters as the men. It would not be traditional farce.
When did your interest in musical theatre begin, Stephen?
When I was about 11 years old, my parents got divorced, and my mother had custody of me, and she was a working woman. And in order to find companionship for me and something for me to do while she was working, she became friendly with the Hammerstein family, the Oscar Hammerstein family of Rodgers and Hammerstein. They had a son my age. And so I became fast friends with him, and the Hammersteins became sort of surrogate parents to me, and I just wanted to do what Oscar did, and he wrote songs, so that's what I did.
So you thought a lot of Oscar?
Oh yes, no, he was a wonderful man, and although I was very fond of my father, but I didn't see my father as much as I could because my mother was fairly bitter about him, and so Oscar became my surrogate father.
And did that relationship extend to him giving you
oh, yes.
tips about how to
oh,
write
indeed, indeed. When music? I was 15 years old, I wrote a musical for school, and I was certain that it was so brilliant that it would be put on, that Hammerstein would want to produce it on Broadway. And of course, it was all about my schoolmates and about the teachers there. You know, it was a so-called satire on everything at the school. And so I brought it to him with every expectation that he would sign a contract right there. And I asked him to judge it as if he didn't know me, as if it was a piece that had just crossed his desk. And he said, all right, if you want me to judge it that way, I must tell you it's the worst thing I've ever read in my life. And he could see my little 15-year-old lip trembling. And he said, I didn't say it was untalented, but if you want to know why it's bad, let's start with the first sentence. And he took me for an afternoon through the script, but what was wonderful was he treated it and me as if I were a grown-up.
So when
there
you
was
were
no condescension.
When you were 15, you had a one-on-one masterclass with Oscar Hammerstein.
You got it. That puts it very well, and all in one afternoon.
Right.
And by the end of that afternoon, I've said this before, and it's an exaggeration, but not much. I think I knew more about songwriting for the theater at the end of that afternoon than most songwriters learn in a lifetime.
So that show was called By George.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, you know. Okay, yes. It was the George School. It was a Quaker school in Pennsylvania, and it was called the George School. So I thought, what a clever title that would be.
Yes, very clever. The the thing that strikes me about that story, Stephen, is that little Stephen Sondheim is not lacking in self-esteem.
Well, no, not now. But it's because Oscar taught me, among other things, among principles of songwriting, to be ruthless about my material, and always not to worry about what other people thought, but what I thought, and not to try to get away with any laziness. So the self-esteem comes from the fact that whether you like what I do or not, I know it's good. Meaning it has been thought about, and that's what he taught me to do.
Let's talk about West Side Story, which is, I guess, your big break. You write the lyrics to West Side Story, to music composed by Leonard Bernstein. How did that come about?
That came about because I had written a show called Saturday Night, Music and Lyrics. It was my first sort of professional show. And in the middle of raising the money for it, the producer, who was a young man, 40 years old, died of leukemia, and so I just used since the show wasn't going to be done because his widow was unable to raise money for it, I used it as an audition piece to sort of peddle my wares around town, and I came to the attention of Arthur Lawrence, playwright, who was about to embark on a musical of a James M. Cain book called Serenade, and it was going to be with a score by Bernstein and direction by Jerome Robbins. And that fell through, but Arthur was impressed enough with what he'd heard of mine that when he and Bernstein Robbins started to make plans for West Side Story, which was a few years later, I ran into him at a party, and they were looking for a lyric writer, and I happened to be at the right party at the right time. And so I played for Bernstein, and they all said, all right, come on aboard, and that's what I did. They were all much older than I, but so it was a real apprenticeship. But I was 25, and I'm, ready, very eager and ready.
Yeah, that is such an exciting encounter. This is Books and Arts Daily on RN, and we're talking to Stephen Sondheim, and we're talking at the moment about West Side Story, for which he wrote the lyrics. As you'll know, it's set in New York City in the mid-1950s, and it's an ethnic blue-collar neighborhood, and it's all about the rivalry between two street gangs, the Jets and the Sharks. Let's have a listen to one of the key songs. This is America, sung by Rita Marina from the 1961 film adaptation.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
Okay. Buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have, though, to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillac zoom in America. Industry boom in America.
12 in a room in America.
lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
The cast of West Side Story, that's the film version, singing America. Stephen Sondheim is with me. I mean, that song, Stephen, really encapsulates the triumph of the spirit over the obstacles that face immigrants.
Well, yes, I suppose. I think that if there are any listeners who don't know the story, those are Puerto Ricans who were very unwelcome in those days, and as a matter of fact, still are in certain sections of the city. Also, not one of those lyrics was on the stage. That's entirely; those are all movie lyrics for that song.
Okay,
I rewrote the whole thing.
So it's got a kind of the stage version has this very gritty, unsentimental worldview, which is quite different from what people, I guess, expect when they go to
musical theater. Yes, West Side Story was not a big hit. In fact, it just about made its money back. It was a big hit movie, but as a show, it did indeed shock a lot of people who expected musicals to be a lot of pretty girls in a chorus line
and escapism. Whereas this was this is confrontation.
Yeah, it's confrontation. Well, although I think being told an absorbing story is also escapism. You know, escapism doesn't have to be just laughs and pretty girls, and escapism can also be Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes, perhaps we could find another word. Escapism is.
They expect a light entertainment. I remember that I went on the second night of the show. I was so proud to have a show on Broadway, and I stood in the aisle and I saw a guy. He was sitting near the back of the thing, and the curtain rose, and there were these six gang members starting to snap their fingers and do ballet steps on the stage, and this guy got up out of his seat. 20 seconds into the show with his coat over his arm and said, excuse me, excuse me, excuse me, and got out, started out of the aisle. And I was standing on the side of the aisle just looking at him in amazement, and he knew somehow that I was connected with the show because of the look on my face, and he just said, don't ask, in an icy voice. And I picture exactly what happened. He'd had a long day at the office. He was on his way home. He thought, oh, I'll stop in and see a musical and relieve myself of my cares and woes and everything. And the curtain goes up on six gang members doing ballet steps. Yeah. And he thought, I'm in the wrong place.
Yeah, this is not for me. Yeah. I always think you've done well if one or two people walk out. If they all walk out, you're
true.
In trouble.
That's true.
But if one or two people walk out and the rest applaud.
If you're going to do a piece like that, you cannot expect that everybody's going to
you've done well.
Going to have a good time.
Now, as we say, you wrote the words, and in that one, Bernstein wrote the music. Did you actually secretly write any of the music yourself?
No. I gave him a vamp. There's a song called Something's Coming, and I sort of gave him an accompaniment for that. I would make little suggestions because the songs he'd written before, he'd written with lyric writers who were not musicians. And so to write with a guy who I majored in music at college, who knew the difference between B-flat and F-sharp, it was that kind of collaboration. But no, I made suggestions, but except for that vamp, no, that's all Lenny's music.
There's my vamp. So a vamp is a little kind of chord pattern.
Right. It's an accompaniment figure.
That lies under
it's the accompaniment
under
rhythm,
the music, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Let's talk about a little light music. Okay. Let's talk about Gypsy first. So Gypsy came first after that. That was 1959. You wrote the lyrics to that. Then a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
Yeah.
Then you began collaborating with producer and director Hal Prince.
Right.
And you worked together on six musicals between 1970 and 1981.
Right.
And this is a very fertile time. You've got Sweeney Todd, Follies, A Little Light Music. Let's hear a little of A Little Night Music. Here's Bernadette Peters singing Send in the Crown, Send in the Clowns from the Broadway production.
Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here, I lost on the ground. You in midair. Send in the clouds. Isn't it bliss?
Send in the Clowns from the 1973 production A Little Night Music. And Judy Collins did a version of that song, which became your first top 40 hit.
Yeah, she made it a hit. That's how that song was around for a couple of years after the show had opened. Nobody sang it. I mean, or virtually nobody sang it. And she made it. She made a recording of it, and I think she made it in England, curiously enough. And it became a hit, and then it was picked up by Frank Sinatra and became a big hit. And but if she hadn't recorded it, I think it, you know, would be obscure.
I heard the English actress Judi Dench singing that recently, and Judi Dench has got a good voice, but not a great voice. No. She's not the singer of the caliber she's an actress. And it struck me as I was listening to her that actually, technically, it's not that hard a song to sing.
Well, it was written for a lady who wasn't a singer, Glynis Johns, and I wrote it for her in the original production. And I knew that she had this small, silvery voice, but not a voice with a capital V. So I also knew that she couldn't sustain notes very long. So I wrote it in short phrases so that she wouldn't have to sustain notes. So she doesn't have to go. For example, you take the word rich, it cuts itself off with a short vowel sound and a hard consonant sound. And so it's not, isn't it rich? And I've heard opera singers do, isn't it rich? And you can't sustain a sound like that. Yeah. And so it's all written in short phrases like that so that Glynis could sing it easily, and she did a brilliant, wonderful job.
So it comes across as little kind of gulps of emotion.
Yes, that's right.
Isn't it rich?
Yes, and that's why they're all questions. When I thought of short phrases, I thought, okay, short phrases, that sounds like questions to me.
Yeah.
And so, because in a short phrase of only four syllables, you can't have a complete sentence of much substance, but you can have a question.
So has that been a skill you've had to use in other situations?
Because, oh, sure.
You know, you're writing music that actually people can sing really powerfully.
That's the difference between opera and musicals. Uh-huh. In writing them, when you write an opera, you just write and then you cast the singers who can sing those notes. If you write a musical and you want, you know, a personality who can act and sing and sometimes even dance, you may not get the kind of voice that you'd like to have, so you tailor the material for the artist, and that's been going on since time immemorial. That doesn't mean it's a compromise. It just means the way Shakespeare knew who he was writing for, because he had a company of actors to write for, and he thought, well, he'll be good as a king. I'll do Richard. Why don't I do Richard for him? It's the same thing. You tailor things not in the writing. You write it with an ideal personality in mind or ideal voice, and then if you cast somebody who can't negotiate something, you don't force them to negotiate. You tinker with it.
Stephen, I've always thought that the key to live performance is to finding ways in which each person who's there can be their best.
Right, absolutely. And also, if you write it that way, then in subsequent revivals, for example, in Little Night Music, I made a mistake. There's one of the leading characters, Anne, has a tessitura, which a total vocal range, of quite low to quite high, because we found a beautiful girl, because she has to be beautiful, and a young girl, she has to be young for the part, who could sing it. And I thought, great. Her name was Victoria Mallory. What I didn't take into account was that once Victoria Mallory was no longer playing the part, like in a revival or in something, nobody else could. You can't find another stunningly beautiful girl who can act and who is the right age and can sing that range. And I thought, oh, that's a mistake. So every time it's cast, you usually have to make a compromise in one of those areas. Either she's not as pretty as you wish, or she doesn't sing as well as you wish, whatever.
Show business can be very cruel, can't it?
But not if you have a practical set of mind.
Stephen Sondheim is with me live here in the studio on Books and Arts. You're on RN with Michael Cathcart. Time magazine called A Little Night Music your most brilliant accomplishment to date. Did you feel as though you'd crossed some kind of line? You'd gone into new territory with it?
No, not really. Not particularly. It was the third of the shows I did with Hal, and the first one was Company, and the second one was Follies, and that was I think it impressed people because it's all written in variations of three and six. They call it waltz musical, but it isn't all waltzes. But it is because I wanted to convey a kind of romantic feel to the show, and so to me waltzes and things in three are either very lively or very romantic. And so I wanted a combination of the two. I didn't want it to get logy, so I wanted things where you could have gallops and things like that that are in six, that have, like Weekend in the Country, that have real kind of energy and drive, and then these waltz-like or waltzes, that waltz-like pieces that would convey a kind of romantic atmosphere.
Let's talk about writing for the movies. You've also written for film. You wrote for the 1981 Warren Beatty film Reds, a movie of which I have very fond memories. Yep. And you wrote five songs for the 1990 movie Dick Tracy, including the song Sooner or Later, which was sung by Madonna, mm-hmm. which won you an Oscar for Best Song. Let's have a little listen to just a bit of that.
Sooner or later you're gonna be Baby, it's time that you faced it. I always get my mind.
Oh, she's good, isn't she?
She was terrific in that part.
Wasn't she? Yeah.
And it was difficult for her to sing that song because it's so different than what she'd been doing. She was actually quite frightened about singing it. And if you see her sing it on the Academy Awards, you can actually see her trembling.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. You can, because you know.
No, if I sat you in front of the set, you'd see it right away.
Is that right? Yeah. Is writing for film different from writing for the stage?
No, not when you're writing musicals. Now, when you're writing a background score, of course it is. When Reds was a background score, whereas Dick Tracy was songs. And it's exactly like writing songs for the stage.
Do you have a favorite?
Favorite of
your own work when you look back?
Oh, you mean of shows?
Yeah.
No, I don't have a favorite, but it does surprise because I like them all for different reasons. But when I'm asked what show would you have on a desert island, as in
Desert Island, that's a good question.
My answer is always startles people, and it's not because I'm on this program right now. It's a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, because if I had to see one show night after night after night after night, that the only thing I had on the desert island, Forum always makes me laugh. I know every word of it. Inside out and backwards. I can recite the entire script right now, but it always makes me laugh.
Right.
And also because it offers performers a chance to clown, to as Bert said, a scenario for vaudevillian. So it's always fresh. But even if it was the same performance night after night after night on that desert island, that's the one I would want.
You would laugh at the same spots every single night.
I always do. I did last night. Raucous laughter. I thought, I can't believe I'm laughing. Yeah. You know, I'm reciting the joke. It's not a joke. I'm reciting the line with the performer.
Did you enjoy Jeffrey Rush?
Oh, very much, sure, very much. I enjoyed the whole cast. I didn't know any of the other cast members the way a lot of Australians know these people.
Yeah, they're familiar. Yes, that's right. True. And the musicians are distributed through the set. They're kind of hidden.
And yes, they're sort of hidden. You sort of
up on the roof.
Up on the roofs of the houses. There are three houses on stage, and and it's quite spectacular looking.
Was there any idea that you saw on stage last night that you thought, yeah, that's a nice touch?
Yes, as a matter of fact, in the opening number, there are some very good – it's hard to describe, and so I won't attempt to because it would probably take me about 5 minutes to describe. But there's a group of three actors called the Proteans who play many, many parts during the evening. And when they're introduced, they represent, like a Roman senator or a Roman citizen. And then I won't spoil it for those people who haven't seen the show, but they are other Roman things too. And some of them were invented either by, I don't know who wrote them, but yeah. They're substitutions for the original, and they're really funny.
And do you have contact with the director?
Yes. And Simon Phillips, he came to New York and we talked about the show at some length. And also Jeffrey came to New York and we talked about it too.
Yeah, well, Simon Phillips has a real knack for making a musical work. Is there another musical in you?
Yeah, I've started one, and I started one last year, and with my collaborator, we got sort of a script, and I've done the opening song and half of the second song, and then 2 months ago, I fell and broke my wrist, and I have been unable to hold a pencil since, and so until the wrist gets healed. The show's in abeyance.
It's supposed to be good for your brain development to learn to write with the other hand.
Nobody told me that.
Perhaps this is the moment to try.
My left hand is virtually useless. I'm so right-handed.
Is that right?
Right.
Just so right-handed.
It's like a piece of meat.
Well, the right-handed Stephen Sondheim, thank you for joining us. No, it's been a great pleasure,
Michael.
To meet you.
Nice
Stephen
meet
Sondheim,
you
composer, lyricist, one of the greats of American musical theatre. And he's in Melbourne to see a revival of his show, A Funny Thing Happened Onto the Way to the Forum. Did I say that right? A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, starring Geoffrey Rush. It's playing at Her Majesty's Theatre in Melbourne until the 6th of January. On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily.